from the council, please come to the council table.
Commissioner Rivera.
Your argument, Commissioner.
On 34, the builder bid a dozen and the bidder made a decision.
May it please the court. This case involves a suit for refund of $68,533.93 in franchise taxes brought by the respondent Hewlett-Packard. The suit involves Hewlett-Packard's 1978 franchise tax return, which was based upon its fiscal year ending October 31st, 1977. Hewlett-Packard attempted to pay its 1978 franchise tax under the three-factor formula as authorized by Article 12.022 of the Franchise Tax Act. However, because Hewlett-Packard failed to petition for the use of that three-factor formula by June 1, 1978, as required in the Controller's Regulation 026-0212-003, hereinafter referred to as Ruling 3, the Controller denied Hewlett-Packard's use of the three-factor formula and issued the deficiency assessment which led to this lawsuit. After a non-jury trial, the trial court entered judgment for petitioners and the Court of Civil Appeals reversed and rendered for the respondent, Hewlett-Packard. The Court of Civil Appeals erred in its opinion, favoring respondent, and judgment should be reversed and rendered for petitioners because respondent did not pay its franchise tax under the gross receipts method of Article 12.021 by June 15, 1978, as required by Article 12.08, nor did it receive permission from the controller to pay under the three-factor formula of Article 12.022. And also the court erred because contrary to the Court of Civil Appeals opinion, Ruling 3 June 1st deadline for alternative petitions is consistent with Articles 12.02 and 12.08, and under this court's opinion in Gerst v. Oak Cliff Savings and Loan Association, Ruling 3 is consistent with and in complete harmony with the franchise tax statute. In Bullock v. Ramada, Texas, Inc., this court interpreted Articles 12.01 and 12.08 so as to work in a logical and orderly manner. In this case, Articles 12.02 and 12.08 must also be properly correlated. Under the clear language of Article 12.022, if the taxpayer has not received the controller's permission to use an alternative formula, the franchise tax must be filed and paid under the gross receipts method of Article 12.021, and it must be paid by June 15th as required by Article 12.08. Hewlett-Packard paid its franchise tax under the three-factor formula on June 15, 1978 without the controller's permission and in derogation of Article 12.021.
Counsel, excuse me, you referred to the first case and the second case. What was the second case you mentioned?
The second case I referred to, Your Honor, was Bullock v. Ramada, Texas, Inc., which this court recently decided wherein Articles 12.01 and 12.08 were meshed together to work in a coherent manner.
Yeah, and I wrote that one.
Yes. It is interesting to note that in Hewlett-Packard's request for extension of time to pay the franchise tax, which request was dated June 1st, 1978, and appears as Exhibit B to the stipulations at Transcript 51, Hewlett-Packard did not pay 90% of its franchise tax as calculated under the gross receipts method as required by Article 1.13, which authorizes request for extension. Instead, Hewlett-Packard paid 90% of its franchise tax as calculated under the three-factor formula, which Hewlett-Packard did not have the permission to use at that time. Moreover, Hewlett-Packard, as is seen by Exhibit G, Transcript 73, which is the controller's deficiency assessment, Hewlett-Packard was off by more than 100% in its estimate of the tax owed under the three-factor formula method. On June 1st, 1978, the date of the application for extension of payment of the franchise tax. Hewlett-Packard had not even petitioned for, yet it paid under the three-factor formula. Hewlett-Packard's mistaken use of the abstention request with its gross error in estimated tax liability points out the real error in this case, and that is Hewlett-Packard's disorganized tax-paying structure with regard to its 1978 Texas franchise tax return. The fault in this case does not lay with any arbitrariness in Ruling 3's June 1st deadline. The June 1st deadline in Ruling 3 is in total accord with Articles 12.02 and 12.08 because 12.02 requires the petition by the taxpayer and a response by the controller, and 12.08 requires payment of the tax by June 15th, no matter which method is used. Also, all of petitioner's witnesses, either former or current employees in the business tax division of the controller's office, testified that the June 1st deadline promotes the goal of having taxpayers pay correctly, timely, and properly. The controller is trying to avoid the assessment of interest and penalties wherever possible. The testimony of Ms. Eleanor Brown, which stated that the vast majority of petitioning corporations receive a response from the controller with regard to a petition for alternative formulas, they receive a response by June 15th, shows that the June 1st deadline is a workable regulation. Under the Court of Civil Appeals opinion, if they would have the controller do everything on one day, they would receive the regular franchise tax returns on June the 15th, and then at the same time they would receive franchise tax returns under alternative reporting methods without the controller having had a chance to approve them, which is contrary to Article 12022's terms. Nowhere in the Franchise Tax Act does the legislature evidence an intent to give any corporation special tax treatment merely because it is petitioning under Article 12022. It makes no sense to have the tax due on June the 15th and for the controller to wait until June the 15th to decide whether the taxpayer has paid the right amount under the proper method. Furthermore, Ruling 3 and its June 1st deadline is meant to apply to all corporations for whatever formulas are proposed and for the future as well. That ruling is meant to apply whether there were 90,000 corporations paying a franchise tax back around 1977 or whether there were 180,000 corporations paying a franchise tax in around 1979 and whether there may be 300,000 corporations paying the franchise tax by the end of this decade. In Gerst, it was this court's view that an agency can spell out the details left out by the legislature by promulgating reasonable procedural regulations to administer a statute. This is exactly what the controller did in Ruling 3. As this court also reasoned in Gerst, and contrary to the Court of Civil Appeals opinion, a regulation does not have to literally match the statute in order to be reasonable. If this were the rule in Texas, then no regulation would ever be needed. Hewlett-Packard's problem rested not on Ruling 3, but on its disorganized nature and lack of information. The statement of fact, and specifically Mr. Agustin Valenzuela's testimony, shows that after June 1, 1978, Hewlett-Packard did thorough research on the Texas Franchise Tax Law. After June 1, 1978, Hewlett-Packard discovered Article 12022 had been available since 1969. After June 1, 1978, Hewlett-Packard determined it wanted to use the three-factor formula, and as of June 1, 1978, Hewlett-Packard did not have its sales factor or payroll factor calculated for the three-factor formula. How can such a corporation complain about the arbitrariness of the June 1 deadline in Regulation 3 when it had not merely even begun to make use of that regulation until after June 1st of the applicable year? In conclusion, while there was testimony that Hewlett-Packard may have put its tax obligation to the federal government and other states before that those of the Texas Franchise Tax. Petitioners have no quarrel with this. However, when the Texas Franchise Tax is to be paid, it should be paid according to the tax statute and to reasonable regulations promulgated by the Comptroller's Office, such as Regulation 3. Based on this argument and those in the application for writ of error, petitioners pray that this court reverse the Court of Civil Appeals judgment and render judgment that respondents take note. Thank you.
Let me ask you a question for information. You tax people, in fact, everything's so hard that you got a rule number 026.02.12.003.
Yes, sir.
Now, what do you call that rule?
What do you mean, Your Honor? What do I call it?
Well, see, you don't say you violated rule 026.02.12.003 in conversation, do you?
No, we call it, well, like here in the argument, Your Honor, you say Regulation 3 or Regulation 003.
Well, why don't you call it Rule 3 or something?
Well, I think that has to do with that Administrative Procedure and Register Act, Your Honor. While I try to make something simple, I think it may have made something more complicated.
So we're going to call this Rule 3?
You could call it Rule 3 for short.
Yes. That helps me. Thank you.
Counsel, before you sit down, let me pose a question so that the opposing counsel can hear it too. Is there a rule which gives the controller the power to make rules and regulations?
Yes, Your Honor. Article 12.12 of the Texas Franchise Tax Act authorizes the controller to promulgate rules and regulations to administer the provisions of the Franchise Tax Act so long as those regulations are consistent with the statutes of this state and with the Constitution of this state and of the federal government.
When was this particular rule promulgated, if you know?
This particular Rule 3, Your Honor, was effective in 1975, but its first predecessor began on April 14, 1972. That was known as Regulation 80-17, and these relevant regulations are attached to the application for writ of error as an appendix. But the first regulation came out on April 14, 1972 with regard to petitions for alternative reports. It's interesting to note that the first regulation...
You've answered the question, counsel.
Okay. Thank you. You still got some time, Rick. You're going to argue some more.
No, that's all right. Thank you.
Gary, you have some response.
In the police court, Mr. Keene Red Dunn has been arguing for employment.
May it please the court. My name is Ray Guy. I'm with Jenkins and Gilchrist in Dallas, and I am here representing the respondent, Hewlett-Packard Company. As Mr. Bernal has said, this case does involve Hewlett-Packard's 1978 franchise tax return. Specifically, the question presented is whether Hewlett-Packard can be denied the right to use an alternative tax computation method for which it satisfies all statutory criteria solely because of an additional deadline imposed by a controller's rule, a deadline not imposed by the statute. The Court of Civil Appeals correctly held on two alternative grounds.
Is there any deadline at all in the statute?
The statutory deadline, Your Honor, is June the 15th for the franchise tax reporting date. Article 12.02, which is the statute which provides for the alternative reporting method, does not specify a deadline.
What we're talking about then is the controller's rule that if you want to change a method from what you've been doing, you've got to give 15-day notice.
That is correct, Your Honor. A corporation which is petitioning for the first time to use an alternative reporting method must, under Rule 3, petitioned by June 1st of the franchise tax reporting year.
Is it your contention that this is a discretionary ruling on the part of the controller, or are you? Is your argument based on that it's arbitrary and as opposed to being reasonable? Is that
That is one of our arguments, Your Honor. We presented several points below. The Court of Civil Appeals held for us on the grounds that the rule was in excess of and in conflict with the statutes themselves, and also that the rule, in effect, imposed a penalty in excess of the penalty which is authorized by, I believe it's Article 12.14. We also argued below, and should this court be inclined to reverse, we ask for consideration of point 5 below, in which we did contend that the rule contravenes due process and the Texas due course of law clause, because it does deprive U.S. taxpayer of his property without due process, or as the Texas Constitution says, the due course of the law of the land. And what that boils down to is correct, that it is arbitrary and capricious and does not serve a useful purpose under the statutory scheme.
Do you take the position that the controller had no power to make this rule?
I do, Your Honor. I think that is what the Court of Civil Appeals held. And I believe that there are several basic principles of statutory construction that support the Court's ruling on this point. To begin with, there is a standard rule of construction in Texas and elsewhere that says that tax statutes are customarily to be construed most strictly against the taxing authority and in favor of the taxpayer. As a second rule, it says that delegations of authority to an administrative agency are to be construed most strictly against the grant and in favor of the person who is being regulated. And any delegation of authority is to be found in either the express terms of the Enabling Act or by the clear implication thereof. And then third, the rule to which Mr. Banal has also alluded, statutes which are on the same purpose or are part of the same statutory scheme are to be considered as in pari materia and construed in context with each other and not in isolation. When you apply these standards to Rule 3, you find, first of all, that, as Mr. Jeffrey's question pointed out, there is no deadline specified in Article 12.02 for petitions for alternative reporting methods. You find, in addition, that Article 12.12, which is an enabling statute in this state, authorizes only such rules and regulations as are not inconsistent with state and federal law, constitutional, statutory, and common law. And then we go further than that because the statute clearly provides for a procedure by which tax reports can be reopened at the behest of either the controller or the taxpayer, where it's appropriate for a period that goes back so far as the 7-year statute of limitations. Article 1.11, for example, part of the same taxation general law and part of the administrative scheme that puts the franchise taxes into effect. It provides for tax credit wherever it is determined that a taxpayer has overpaid his taxes by reason of a mistake of law or a fact. Article 1.11a was recently enacted to take that one step further and provide for a refund where a taxpayer has erroneously overpaid his taxes. Those are both tied into Article 1.045, which in 1.045G states that the time period during which refunds or credits are authorized shall not be any shorter than the period granted to the controller for issuing deficiency assessments. And that period, in its base, is 7 years. There is some provision if there is a gross disparity between the amount of tax paid and the amount that's due, whereby, as I understand it, the controller could go back even further than 7 years.
So Council, just off the top of my head, a requirement, a rule which says if a taxpayer wants to change his method of paying and the law gives him that right, but he should let us know 15 days before the due date. Just off the top of my head, that doesn't sound like an unreasonable requirement, and I'm concerned if that's unreasonable. I'm concerned about the effect upon these rules and regulations that some 150 boards and commissions, including this court, make with respect to time. 3 days notice for motions, 5 days notice for verdict process and forcible entry cases, 30 days to perfect an appeal. Our law is honeycombed with all of these time requirements.
It certainly is, Your Honor, and that is clearly the thing that cuts on the other side. That is the concern that must be raised here. I think for several reasons it can be answered. First of all, the types of things to which you are talking are rules that set down a period for deciding upon a particular motion, typically a hearing, for example. You mentioned forcible entry and container action. Motions to be heard in court. There must be some time for the court to pass upon those in advance of the date when the motion must be heard and decided. The problem is that in this case, there is no particular sacrosanct nature to June the 15th. Mr. Bernal's argument seems to assume that the controller has one day in which this flood of tax returns comes in which it must pass upon whether those tax returns are proper or not. In fact, the testimony below showed that, for example, whereas there were something like 180,000 taxpayers last year, Eleanor Brown, who is one of the people in the business tax division, testified that there were over 29,000 underpayment notices sent out. Now, each one of those requires the controller after June 15th, presumably, because most of the returns will probably come in sometime around June 15th, to find a reason why there's some problem, to inform the taxpayer of that, and to issue a deficiency assessment for tax, interest, and, if it's appropriate, penalties. So 29,000 cases to start with have a problem because of underpayment. There was an additional several thousand, and I can't recall the exact number, it is in the record, of cases that require some other kind of response. We're talking in this case about gradually moving up to this last year, I believe it was 99 petitions for first-time alternative methods. That is 0.3% of 1 per 1,000 petitions that we're talking about that require some kind of underpayment notice. In fact, June 15th is a continuous activity by the controller after that day in which it protects its interest and the interest of the state of Texas by assessing interest and penalty where it's appropriate. There is nothing that happens that carves that June 15th date in stone. And that is why a requirement that is in the rule and not in the statute that does not appear on the franchise tax reporting return, as far as I recall, which requires an additional advance deadline, is not one that actually serves a particular purpose that has anything other than a negligible effect upon the controller. And further, the point to which I was addressing is the fact that the rule specifically authorized reconsideration of returns even after they're filed at the behest of either party. Now, what the controller has done here with Rule 3 is, with respect to petitions, first-time petitions, the three-factor formula, close that door to the taxpayer. I'm not going to speculate exactly, but it would seem to me that there is at least a very good argument that under, for example, Article 1.11, a taxpayer who is not apprised, for whatever reason, of the potential for alternative reporting methods, has overpaid his taxes because of a mistake of law.
When at this point, Counselor, let me ask you a broad question like that. Quote, Article 12.02 says you may petition and the controller may permit. I take it that doesn't mean must.
That is certainly correct, Your Honor.
Okay. If he may permit, is it unreasonable for the controller to say, I will permit if you do this? Otherwise, he could not permit because he didn't like the color of your hair. It's unreasonable for him to say, I will permit under these conditions and tell you what the conditions are.
If the conditions themselves are reasonable, I would think you certainly have some prerogative.
And you don't think 15 days is reasonable?
Under these circumstances.
I'm not arguing against it. I just need some help.
I appreciate your question. That is precisely the problem. And Justice Pope's question and yours address the question of whether or not I am coming in as a greedy taxpayer trying to disrupt the oily procedure.
No, that's not the issue. In other words, you may be perfectly entitled to it. It's not a matter of greed or not.
Well, I didn't mean to make this intent to imply that you were insinuating that at all. My point simply is, Your Honor, that the may permit is not an unfettered grant of discretion to the controller, or it itself would have to fall under Texas Constitution and law. The statute says may permit if reasonable. And the record clearly shows that in this case, substantively at any rate, the three-factor formula is reasonable. We have stipulations, we have admissions that say, for example, that if the petition had been filed on June the 1st, it would have been granted. If filed on June 2nd, denied. We have admissions that say that the three-factor formula more fairly represents the extent of the petition, respondent credit, business activity in Texas, which is the statutory language. The problem is, again, that what the controller has done, in addition to being an arbitrary rule, which simply does not aid any particular interest of the controller, in light of the fact that there are so many more underpayments and overpayment notices going out each year, again, this amounts to 0.3% of 1%, assuming that every corporation petitions for alternative reporting methods and currently with its franchise tax return on June the 15th. And every one of those corporations is wrong, and every one of those corporations has to get an underpayment notice and a deficiency assessment, then we're adding 0.3% to a burden that is already upon the controller. Now, in light of the very substantial deprivation of property that results, the due process and due course of law clauses, I think, render that arbitrary and unreasonable. The rules simply indicate, or the record simply indicates, that there is no reasonable interest being served here. The processing of petitions is not difficult. The controller has himself, and what I think also marks his action as arbitrary, decided that the controller's office is never going to voluntarily grant a petition for anything other than three-factor reporting. Separate accounting, other things which are permitted by Article 12.102 and which are given lip service by Rule 3 are never approved. And according to Ms. Brown's testimony below, the only time when a taxpayer gets permission to use anything other than three-factor as a petition is if it goes to court. That simplifies the process. Mr. Basir testified that when he reviewed three-factor petitions, it took about 5 minutes to review one. All they look for is to see that they are regular on their face. There's no outside audit done in the typical case. If the three factors all are not something approximating zero, the petition is going to be granted. There is, as Mr. Charlie Nye, who drafted the predecessor rule, who was the director of the Business Tax Division up until 1977, as he said when he left, the administrative burden involved in processing these petitions is very minor. There simply does not seem to be an interest on the other side of the rule that would justify the substantial deprivation of property. Now that is essentially the due process argument and the argument that addresses reasonability. You have to add into that, I think, on any consideration, the fact that the statutes clearly do contemplate reopening the tax return. You need not decide in this case that corporations should come in and petition for refunds or tax credits based upon their prior tax years if they suddenly find out that they could have used three-factor consideration. That is not required here. But I think it is certainly relevant to the question of whether or not the statutory, the rule of requirement is reasonable and whether it's consistent with the statute, to know that what the controller has done here by Rule 3 is to simply say for the taxpayer, June 1st, not even June 15th, but June 1st, carve in stone the method by which you want to report your taxes. However, we are not going to be so bound. And the controller can go back, find that there was an underpayment made, as they in fact did for Hewlett Packard, depending on about $575,000 for prior tax years, and then deny the taxpayer petition to compute its deficiency on the basis of the three-factor formula. Because for those tax years that are involved here, you did not petition by June 1st. You must have done that, and you may never again consider any other method than the gross receipts formula for those years. As this court said in Spade versus Moritz Wells Company, this court will not lightly attribute to the legislature an intent to work an injustice. A case is found at 141 Texas 634. The quote is at 175 South of 2nd 238 at 242. That is what's been occasioned here. An injustice has been worked because the controller has appropriated to himself the power to forever cut off consideration of three-factor or other alternative formulas prior to the franchise tax reporting deadline, when he himself can go back in and reopen the years for other purposes. Your Honor, as this court ruled in unconditionally refusing the writ in Kelly versus Industrial Accident Board, which is found at 358 Southwest 2nd 874, it's an Austin case that refused in 1952, although the legislature can delegate power to an administrative agency to make rules and regulations, quoting here, the rules and regulations so enacted by the administrative body may not impose additional burdens, conditions, or restrictions in excess of or inconsistent with the statutory provisions. For these reasons, it would appear to me, and we continue to assert, that the Court of Civil Appeals correctly held that Rule 3, with its requirement of a June 1st deadline, is in excess of and contrary to the statute. Now, that's the argument on the statute. I believe there is an independent ground for affirming the Court of Civil Appeals judgment. The court went further to hold that Rule 3 imposes a penalty in excess of that required by law. That ruling was not attacked by a point of error. And this court, as far as I can tell, could affirm this judgment simply because that point was not brought forward. The penalty involved is prescribed by rule by article, rather, 12.14, which says that up to a 10% penalty can be assessed. Hewlett Packard has, in fact, been assessed and has paid under protest such a 10% penalty. As this state law says, any sum of money which is exacted by way of punishment for failing to do something, in this case, failing to petition by June the 1st, is a penalty. As the familiar rule of statutory construction says, penalties are to be construed strictly against the grant of the penalty power. Hewlett Packard has been assessed additional tax by reason of the denial of permission to use an alternative reporting method to which it is substantively entitled, because it did not get that petition in on June the 1st.
Back to this statute to which the chief alluded.
Yes, sir.
The statute says the taxpayer may petition for and the comptroller may permit and so forth if reasonable. The comptroller would have, for good cause or pretty good cause, the power to deny the alternative method of taxation. And it's your position that simultaneously with filing your return, you make the request, and any the allowance of even a day for the controller to exercise his statutory power is unauthorized by statute.
Yes, Your Honor, in light of both the statute and the practice, as it was adduced below. The testimony below showed that by no means all petitions, even if they come in by June the 1st, are acted upon by June the 15th. The testimony below from the petitioner's witnesses was inclined to show, or attempted to show, that what is involved here is an attempt to do an orderly procedure. The attempt was to show that petitions come in by June the 1st and are out by plenty of time before June the 15th, so the taxpayer gets a call, is told what method to use, and knows what basis to file a tax return on. In fact, the witnesses said that by no means all petitions are acted upon by that time. There's a lot going on at that time, and there's simply no reason to think that every taxpayer is going to know on what basis to cover himself. Now, the statute provides for protection for the controller. He may assess an underpayment notice, as he does in what is amount to about 1/5 of the cases each year. He may require, if it's appropriate, interest, and that will be required in every case, and a penalty in some cases. That is the procedure provided for by statute for the controller to, in effect, punish any taxpayer who fails to pay the full tax due according to the proper determination of whether it's gross receipts, refactor, other alternative methods. With that in mind, I think it is clear that if it could be shown that in reality every corporation was petitioned by June the 1st, got a ruling back, and could get a tax return in by June the 15th, and if it could be shown that for some reason the controller was able to lock up this process by June the 1st, or rather the 15th, both in practice and by statutory authority, then the advance petition requirement might be reasonable. In this case, given what seems to be a fairly low interest served, I think it is unreasonable. The testimony further shows that petitions are fairly well spread out throughout the year. Mr. Nye, again, the person who drafted the predecessor ruling and who then incorporated that into the present Rule 3, said that most petitions are in by June the 1st. You get some after that, but most of them are in. Eleanor Brown said otherwise. She said there is some buildup by up until May the 31st, but it doesn't seem that taxpayers customarily wait until June the 1st. It happens sometimes. It happened to Hewlett Packard. But there is no indication that there's that much of a bulge at that time, particularly in light of the fact that there are only about 100 a year coming in for first-time consideration.
Would you suppose that maybe the reason they don't have those problems is because they have orderly rules?
I certainly hate to speculate on that, Your Honor. That's what the people below attempted to say about Rule 3. That is the way it works. Although Mr. Bashir fairly succinctly said it was strictly a matter of administrative ease. Just to bring it around. The court asked for a proper characterization of Rule 3. I think my client would be able to furnish another one, but I'm not sure if it's appropriate to furnish to the court at this time. It would be a convenient shorthand, I'm quite sure. For all these reasons, it appears to me that the rule simply does not, if inconsistent with the statute, it imposes a penalty in excess of that which is authorized by law. And when you consider that, as Mr. Nye testified, it was drafted, or rather its predecessor was, with the idea that there would be 350 to 400 applications each year. And when you consider that, in fact, the year 1972 that the rule was drafted, there were only 30 or 40 that came in, and it has only gradually built up to 100. I think the record shows pretty clearly that Rule 3, with the June 1st requirement, is basically an idea whose time has passed. It doesn't serve a useful purpose. And no matter how much the controller attempts to characterize it as being one that allows the controller to make his rules in advance of June 15th, June 15th is simply not a date that's carved in stone. You better get your tax return in by that time. There's certainly no guarantee that you're going to hear back anytime, even shortly after that. And the statute clearly contemplates reopening tax returns even back into the past years. As I said, Hewlett Packard is undergoing that now, and there is a substantial penalty assessed and deficiency for years back to 1972. The statute clearly contemplates allowing both parties to go back. The rule contravenes that. This court need do no more than rule that June 15th, which is the only deadline specified in Article 12, is the date for filing the petition. And all the court needs to do, and I believe it's the reasonable decision to do, is to affirm the Court of Civil Appeals. On that basis, we respectfully request that that be done. I would like to ask, I'm embarrassed about having submitted several citations that were not in the brief. It might be more convenient if I did, in 7 days, submit a post-commission brief, and I would ask the Commission to do that.
Motion made. Thank you, Counsel. Yep, rebuttal argument from petitioner.
And please, the court. The first argument I'd like to address is that with regard to the assessment of a penalty in some way by Rule 3's June 1st deadline, and that was a denial of due process with regard to Hewlett-Packard. The Comptroller's Office did not deny any due process to Hewlett-Packard. The facts clearly show that Hewlett-Packard denied any due process that is an issue in this case to itself by waiting until after June 1st, 1978 to get its work in order with regard to an alternative petition for the three-factor formula. Any injustice in this case was worked by Hewlett-Packard upon itself and not the state. There is no indication in the record as to why between October 31st, 1977, the end of Hewlett-Packard's relevant fiscal year, and June 1st, 1978, it could not have petitioned in time for this three-factor formula. Your Honors, I would also like to cite to this court a case which is not included in my brief, and it is styled Maryland Casualty Company versus Lee, 165 Southwestern 2nd, 135, out of the Galveston Court of Civil Appeals, writ refused. And in that case, the court stated, any sum required to be paid in the absence of an obligation is a penalty and note and not interest, since interest is calculated on the principal sum which is owing, and until there is a principal sum, there can be no interest. In this case, there was a specific obligation on Hewlett-Packard to pay under the gross receipts method of Article 12.02 and to pay by June 15th under Article 12.08. because Hewlett-Packard had not received permission to use that alternative formula by the Comptroller's Office prior to the time that it petitioned for the use of such formula on June 15, 1978. Where can Hewlett-Packard show that it had the authority to partially pay under the three-factor formula on June 1, 1978, when it had not even petitioned for the use of such formula, much less not receive permission to use such formula from the Comptroller's Office? Now, Hewlett-Packard tries to show this court that the 7-year statute of limitations for Article 1.11a is somehow a substitute for statutes which call for payments of taxes by a specific due date. That is not the purpose of Article 1.11a or Article 1.045g. those statutes give the controller's office the authority to determine on his own that if a taxpayer has overpaid his taxes by mistake of fact or mistake of law, the controller can do something about that by granting that taxpayer credit within the 7-year limitations period. Or if the taxpayer has underpaid his taxes, the controller must issue a deficiency determination within 7 years. Now the important question to ask there, well, when does the controller begin to measure that 7-year period? He begins to measure it from the date that the tax is due. The 7-year period is not a substitute for a tax due date. It's a supplemental statute that is used to work with those due dates. It is not a statute which authorizes the controller or the court to ignore a statutory tax deadline such as the June 15th date of Article 12.08. Under Hewlett-Packard's reasoning, there is no logic because a taxpayer who pays under the gross receipts method of Article 12.022, he'd be required to pay clearly under 1202 and 1208 by June 15th of the franchise tax payment. But they're arguing, well, if we're going to petition for an alternative formula, we don't have to pay by June 15th. Under 111 and 104.5G, the controller has 7 years to wait for our tax payment. And that argument is also incorrect because there can be no logic also for the controller to have imposed the burden on taxpayers to petition for the use of an alternative formula during a particular franchise tax year and then have corporations who do not so petition but pay under the regular gross receipts method by June 15th, there's no logic in giving a taxpayer the benefit of additional 7 years merely because he's petitioning for the use of an alternative formula. If that were the case, then it'd be crazy to pay under the regular method. Just petition for an alternative method, even though you know you're not going to be have it be allowed, at least you're going to be buying yourself 7 years. The corporation will be buying themselves 7 years, making the use of that money for that 7-year period, merely because 111 and 104.5G are being attempted to be improperly used as substitutes for the tax due date. The thing to remember is there's a tax due date for the sales tax, a tax due date for the hotel tax, a tax due date for any tax administered by the controller's office. And those due dates have to be properly enforced in order for there to be an orderly administration of the tax statutes of this state. No statutes are being proposed as substitutes for those tax due dates. Now, it was not my intention to give this court the impression that all of the tax returns come in on June 15, 1978, or that all the petitions for alternative relief come in on May the 31st of a particular year. They don't. A lot of them come in way earlier than May 31st of the franchise tax year, which I think shows that the June 1st deadline is a very workable solution and workable regulation. Now also, Mr. Guy referred to the fact that petitions for alternative formulas are also filed throughout the entire year, even after June 15th. Now that is true, but it is not with regard to corporations such as Hewlett-Packard, which have previously paid a franchise tax. That happens with regard to corporations who are paying their franchise tax for the very first time, their first year report, and that report is due 90 days from the date of the end of their first year, which is going to fall on the anniversary date of their charter, if they're a Texas corporation, or on the anniversary date of their granting of the certificate of authority by the Secretary of State's office, if they're a foreign corporation. So Hewlett-Packard does not fall in that category of first-year corporation. Now, also, in line with the argument involving 104.5G and 111A, it is true that underpayment notices and overpayment notices go out at all times during the year. But that is not the fault of the corporation, of the controller's office. If an underpayment notice goes out, it's because for some reason the taxpayer has not calculated his taxes properly. or if an overpayment notice goes out, it is because the controller has determined that the taxpayer may be, because of a mathematical reason or otherwise, paid too much money. But just because the controller's office is performing duties throughout the entire year, that is no reason to say he can perform his duties with regard to alternative petitions for the entire year. That was just the point that he has been trying to make throughout this litigation, is that between, in the 2 weeks between June the 1st and June the 15th, the controller's business tax division does not stop all operations in that division and say, hey, for these 2 weeks, we're merely going to consider petitions for alternative formula. They've got to perform other duties. They've got to answer phone calls from the taxpayers. They've got to promulgate additional regulations. They've got to prepare for administrative hearings at the controller's level. This ruling allows the controller to sufficient time to consider petitions and get response back to the taxpayers. And also allows him to do that in an orderly manner and to allow all taxpayers to pay their taxes on time. And the fact that a few of them may not accomplish that, that a few corporations may not pay their taxes in time, is no reason to say that this regulation is unlawful. In closing, I'd like to refer to this court's opinion in Gurris, which I think very squarely fits this case. And I'd like to read from page 706 of that opinion, which is at 432 Southwestern 2nd. And this court stated, quote, the Court of Civil Appeals has concluded that Rule 2.4F is a requirement in addition to the statutory requirements enumerated in Section 2.08 of Article 852A only. Rather than giving to the administrative agency the right to supplement the statute or to incorporate in specific regulations the public policy of the state as declared in Article 852A as a whole, it was never the intention of the legislature to cause the session of the Finance Commission to operate in a straitjacket in exercising its rulemaking powers granted under Article 342.114. In exercising the powers and the broad authority granted by the legislature, the only requirement is that rules and regulations must be consistent with the Constitution and statutes of this state, close quote. And then this court continued on the same page. The legislature, in creating the board and conferring upon it the power to make rules and regulations necessary to carry out the purposes of the act, forecloses the thought that the legislature intended to spell out the details of all operations under the act, close quote. So in Gurris, the Court of Civil Appeals there did the same thing it did in this case and say, hey, there is no June 1st deadline in Article 12022, so it's got to be law. Well, the language of this court in the Gurris opinion shows that much more than that is involved. The court also said, quote, the Court of Civil Appeals has failed to recognize that courts shall not look solely to one particular section of the Act, but must look to all applicable provisions of the Act, close quote. And that's what I'm saying has to be done in this case. You can't just read 12022 and see that June 1st is absent from that statute and say, Hewlett-Packard wins. You've got to correlate 12022 with 1208, the tax-paying deadline of June 15th, which applies to all taxpayers, no matter which method they use to pay the tax, and which the controller tries very hard to see that all taxpayers meet, not just those that pay under the gross receipts method. I think it's also very important to note that under the Muway Oil Company case and the Southwestern Apparel case cited in petitioner's application for writ of error, the regulations involved in those cases were outside the literal language of the statutes involved, but they were allowed because they were tools that could be used by the controller's office to properly administer the taxes that were at issue in this case. It's merely the same idea, for example, with regard to a case involving the Texas Alcoholic Beverage Commission. There is nothing in the Alcoholic Beverage Code that states that mixed beverage permittees have to keep complimentary drink records. However, the commission has promulgated such a rule because when they go to audit a taxpayer, he is going to be taxed unless that he's going to be taxed on those complimentary drinks unless the taxpayer can show that he has kept such a record of complimentary drinks. That is merely a tool to properly
enforce. What's the basis for giving complimentary drinks?
Well, Your Honor, it's merely a right of the businessman to give a drink away.
So the charity is capricious.
Well, it might be arbitrary and capricious on his part, but he has that right. In closing, I'd just like to say that, to me, the argument that we didn't meet the June 1st deadline and therefore it's arbitrary and capricious and denied us due process is no different than a taxpayer arguing that he did not meet the 90-day deadline for filing a tax protest suit under Article 1.05, and therefore that statute is arbitrary and capricious and has denied him due process. Thank you.
Counsel, the case is submitted on written briefs and oral arguments of both parties. Let me say to counsel for respondent that there was some miscommunication yesterday. There was a second case set today which was settled, and you were set for two, and we had been informed that you had not been informed that you could come at 2 o'clock, and we understand that you were so informed and that we changed your arrival time to 9 o'clock this morning. In any event, we appreciate your making the effort, and as I saw the TV last night, and you couldn't have made it in an airplane. We appreciate your coming, and I trust your client will be impressed. Marshall will adjourn the court.